Hello everyone, welcome to the episode number 11 on the Soundologia podcast. I'm your host Peđa Kovačević, and today I have the privilege of sitting down with one of the leading figures in contemporary classical music in the United States and around the world. My guest's music has been performed globally and across continents. He has composed a wide range of music, spanning 200 works in different genres, including vocal and instrumental pieces, music for the stage, movies, documentaries, and works with electronics and fixed media. Some of his works have been premiered or performed in both Croatia and my home country, Serbia. My guest explores different perspectives on time, creating a unique listening experience. In his compositions, time suspension is achieved through reductionism, a technique he may have inherited from his professors, notably Professor Morton Feldman. Some of the newest theories, including biocentrism, have influenced his music. So when you listen to it, you enter a new dimension where time and space are not independent realities, but rather constructs of our mind. When people describe my guest's music as strange, he takes it as a compliment. He doesn't prioritize virtuosity. Instead, he focuses on other aspects of technique and control that performers and soloists emphasize. I am pleased to have composer Orlando Jacinto Garcia at the Soundologia studio. Orlando was born in Havana, Cuba, and later moved to the United States in 1961 with his parents. After living in Baltimore, he has been residing in Miami for over 30 years. He's not only a renowned contemporary music composer, but also a leader who has founded and led influential organizations, festivals, and ensembles in South Florida. Garcia is the founder and director of the Nodus Ensemble, the Miami chapter of the International Society for Contemporary Music, and the new Music Miami ISCM Festival. Additionally, he serves as a resident composer for the Miami Symphony. In the academic sphere, he is a distinguished university professor and composer in residence for the School of Music at Florida International University. Garcia has received 5 Latin Grammy nominations in the Best Contemporary Classical Composition category. Many publishers have chosen to publish his recordings, including New Albion, Capstone, iNova, Telos, Toccata Classics, and Metier Divine Art. He has received numerous honors and awards, including Rockefeller, Fulbright, Knight, Civitella, and many more. Welcome, Professor. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here with me and our listeners today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Miami, the city you've called home for decades, is where our conversation begins. It's the place you settled in after leaving Baltimore, which you moved to from Cuba. We would love to hear about your impressions of the city and what the music scene was like when you first got to Miami. Can you share some of your memories with us, like what was the cultural and contemporary music scene like in Miami when you first got to Florida?
Well, when I first got to Florida, it was to come to graduate school at the University of Miami because I wanted to study with the professor there, Dennis Kamm, who was very interested in what I was interested in, which is basically a music that unfolded slowly, the minimalist composers, John Cage, the New York School, etc. And that was kind of unique at that time. And we're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. That's really when I came down here. So the music scene at that time was really very jazz influenced here in Miami. That's really what was the most active activity was that. And slowly the new music scene started to develop, primarily at the University of Miami with Dennis and some of his colleagues. And it eventually then expanded from there. But at that time, it was really not much going on whatsoever. So one of my interests was being involved in trying to champion new music in this community. And so after I graduated from the university in the mid-80s, mid to late 80s with my doctorate, I established an organization called the South Florida Composers Alliance, and we did a lot of different concerts and what have you. And Eventually, that organization transformed into the Subtropics South Florida Composers Lion Subtropics Festival that my great friend and colleague Gustavo Matamoros took and moved forward with. And that was an important part of what was going on here. Meanwhile, I started teaching at Florida International University, where fortunately I had the possibility to create my own festivals, starting with a festival called May in Miami in the early 90s that was partnered with the New World Symphony. And then shortly thereafter, the New Music Miami Festival, which has been going on for 27 years now. And we've presented many, many, many composers and performers. And in fact, part of it obviously is for our students to hear all of this music. But on top of that, it's become a very important part of the culture of South Florida because our concerts and events are open to everyone. So that gives you kind of a little snippet. I mean, I will say that since the late 70s, early 80s, and when I got here, the new music scene has flourished and expanded, as has all of the cultural scenes here in South Florida. Art Basel had a huge impact in the visual arts scene, and all that brings with it. The New World Symphony, it's another cultural jewel of South Florida that's here. And there are other people doing things. I know you've interviewed some of them. Some of them are my former students, which I try to instill a real love for presenting new music, contemporary work, and what have you. And several of them are involved in doing that here. So for me, the more activity, the better. So,
yeah, Dorothy Heinemann, my previous guest, already mentioned a couple of things that you just said, like Miami as a city for visual art. And she also mentioned South Florida Composer Alliance as one of the strongest organizations back then that started promoting contemporary music scene. Do you have any interesting or fun facts that you can share with our listeners?
Well, a fun fact that a lot of people don't know, I don't know if it's fun, but an important fact that some people probably don't know is that in 1988, there was a major festival here called New Music America. And Gustavo was involved with it. He was one of the coordinators of the festival. He worked kind of administratively. I was involved because I was very fortunate to have gotten a commission to write a new piece for orchestra and soprano. Mm-hmm. And that festival, the New Music America Festival, was a major festival during the 80s into the early 90s that would take place in a different city every year. And it would bring just a ton of music for that week, a ton of new music. And a lot of it very experimental to that city. And we were very fortunate to have Joseph Celli, who was composer, oboist. He's up in Connecticut and has a fantastic radio show up there. He kind of moved up there after a while, but he was a performer, kind of an improviser on the oboe, very much involved in the contemporary music scene. And he and his then partner, Mary Luft, who was a tremendous force here in South Florida, a cultural force in South Florida, with her Tiger Tail Productions. Mm-hmm. The two of them ran this festival. They coordinated this festival. And the New World Symphony, who was just opening, was the orchestra for the festival.
Interesting.
So this was in 88, 1988. And that was a huge, huge impact. And at that time, Gustavo's work with the festival kind of propelled him to start the Subtropics Music Festival. And that was part of the South Florida Composers Alliance that I had started. And Gustavo came on as a volunteer first, and then he just, you know, we got a grant to pay him to be the executive director, and he just took it over, and he took it. It coincided with me starting working at FIU, so my disposable time was very shortened. And Gustavo just took it and ran with it, and, with grants, and he took it in his own direction, and it's been an extremely successful festival. The Subtropics Music Festival is a very important festival, and his direction is more in the sound art, mm-hmm, type of category, which nowadays is kind of blurred between what sound art is and other expressions are. But this was a very, very major event. It was a huge event. I mean, it was, you know, concerts everywhere. John Cage was here, but also composers from the other aesthetics, so to speak. Charles Warnon was here. The Kronos Quartet played Feldman's quartet that lasts several hours. They played that at one of the local churches. It was a very impactful event. And I think it really set the stage for lots of other things that happened afterwards. Like I said, that was the New World Symphony's first concert. Dennis Russell Davies, an incredible conductor, conducted my piece. Mm-hmm. And Michael Tilson Thomas conducted other works. There was music, like I say, by Steve Reich, by Charles Warnon, which are like two different, very different aesthetics, right? So you had kind of a more academic aesthetic, as well as the music coming out of the New York School and Cage and the downtown composers, as they were labeled back then. And so it was fantastic for me to be involved with this. I recall my piece was premiered with the New World Symphony with Joan LaBarbera, soprano, was a soprano that was here, who was at that time a major, major figure. Mm-hmm. And on that same concert, there was a wonderful work by Lou Harrison, who was here, great composer, and Anthony Davis, worked for, that had, I remember what stood out to me of his work, but it was a wonderful work, and it had a drum set in it. Mm-hmm. Drum set was part of the soloist with the orchestra out front. So that was a major experience for me. And I was, you know, in my early 30s, so I was like this young composer. That was a great opportunity for me. And like I said, it signaled the beginning of the Subtropics Festival, in a sense, because it took place shortly thereafter. And it's moved from there. So I don't know if that's a fun fact, but I think it's an important fact.
I'm curious, do you sometimes miss the old days when Miami wasn't as saturated and crowded as it is now? And do you feel nostalgic for a time when people and artists put more passion into their projects, into their pursuits, compared to today when artists fight for grants to survive and keep up with their work?
Yeah, I don't feel like I'm fighting with anybody for grants. So, so I don't feel that way. On the contrary, what I do feel sometimes is that because we have developed kind of our own scenes, we don't get together as much as we should probably. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, my colleagues at the University of Miami across town are all good friends, but because everybody's so busy, we don't see each other as often as probably as we should or could. Even with Gustavo, who's a great friend. I mean, Gustavo was an undergrad at the University of Miami when I was doing my graduate work, and he was easily the most interesting undergrad composer there by far, and probably with some of the grads as well. I mean, he was really interesting in what he was doing. So it hasn't surprised me that he's done everything that he's done, and he's
right.
And you know, and he's done it outside of academia, which is a real testament.
True.
You know, I've had the university's backing, which it makes a big difference, huge difference. I mean, it's still challenging, but it makes it a lot easier than if you're out on your own as a freelancer trying to sustain yourself. So
it's much harder. That's definitely. How do you see the city and the cultural scene in the future, like in 50 years from now, considering some important factors such as economy, migrations, tourism, ecology, environment, and so on?
Yeah, I don't see it going backwards. I see a continual progression forward. Obviously, it's hard to predict the future, but I think that there's quite a bit of variety of things, and there's lots of performers coming here because there are opportunities for them. Mm-hmm. So there's performers coming here, and there's composers, and I mean, as long as we have major universities, you know, the program at the University of Miami and the program at Florida International University where I am are major programs for composition and technology, and the students that come out of there, a lot of them stay here. Mm-hmm. and find ways to continue, and they're part of the ecology, the cultural ecology of the community. So I only see, you know, positives. Now, can I predict the future? No. I mean, we have to deal with sea level rise, obviously, where we live here and around the whole world, actually, at some level. But we have to deal with that here, certainly where I live on Miami Beach, mm-hmm. something that's discussed all the time. What is this going to look like, you know, 25, 30 years from now? I think you had mentioned what's when we talked earlier, you said, what is it 50 years from now? I said, 50 years from now. Who knows what will be happening 50 years from now? So I'm happy just for the next 5 to 10 years. So I think, you know, like my festival has been going on for 27 years. So it's already, you know, it has kind of a history, and it has kind of a reputation. My hope is that will just continue on with the help of my colleague, Jacob Sudol, mm-hmm. who's my colleague at Florida International University. He runs our technology program. He's a fantastic composer, and extremely, extremely gifted and capable. And so my hope is that we'll keep that going. And he's much younger than I am, so, you know, so he could go on for another 27 years.
Yeah, I like you use the phrase cultural ecology. I've never heard that. It's an interesting phrase.
Well, there's the reason I say that is because there is actually... There are interactions between the different arts. So it isn't like just the composers are over here, you know, and with the performers, mm-hmm. and then you know, the painters are over here, and
right.
you know, and the visual, you know, visual artists are over here, and the poets are over here. No, I mean, right now I'm working with an incredible Cuban poet Carlos Pintado on a libretto for an opera that we're kind of kicking around. He's an incredible poet. And so I'm working with him. I've worked with Jacek Kolasinski, who you know.
Yeah.
Jacek is an incredible visual artist.
One of my mentors.
One of your mentors. And he's done, you know, we've collaborated on works with video, and what have you. I collaborated with Campbell McGrath, who's a MacArthur genius poet. Mm-hmm. I've collaborated with dancer choreographers, Augusto Soledad, an incredible dancer with his brass dance company. So there's a lot of that going on, you know, and we'll go out and have a drink and talk. You know, not all that different from, you know, what the New York School, obviously I don't want to put us in the same category as the New York School and the New York School of Painters and Composers, but it's the same type of thing where, you know, we get together, have a beer and talk about possible collaborations and aesthetics and different concepts and what have you. And so to me, that's kind of the cultural ecology that I'm mentioning, you know, earlier.
Terrific.
So it isn't just the composers getting together, although we do. Right now, I'm working with Carlos Fueyo, who's an incredible, incredible artist. He's got incredible special effects chops. He's worked on the Marvel films. He's worked on all these films that he's done effects. But he has his own thing. He's creating a science fiction movie because he loves Stanley Kubrick.
Interesting.
And I love Stanley Kubrick. So we're working on this short 30-minute science fiction film that I'm very excited about doing the music for, because I love the music in 2001. A Space Odyssey was one of the first movies that I watched that turned me on to contemporary music.
Yeah.
Contemporary classical music back in late 60s, early 70s.
As someone who founded or led several organizations, festivals or ensembles like the International Society for Contemporary Music, ISCM, the New Music Miami Festival and the Nodus Ensemble, could you share a bit about the history from its inception to where it stands now? Has the mission of the New Music Miami Festival evolved over time?
Yes, I briefly mentioned back in the first part of the 90s, the exact year escapes me, although I think it was 93, I was able to partner with the New World Symphony to start a festival for young composers. Mm-hmm. Since, you know, the New World Symphony, it's an incredible orchestra, but it's young performers for the most part.
Fellows.
You know, so they're, yeah, most of them are like whatever, in their early 20s, whatever. And incredible performers. And so they see themselves as a training orchestra. So what I did was I said, listen, what if we start a festival where I bring in young composers, again, about the same age, or, you know, young composers are finishing undergrad, maybe graduates starting graduate school, bring them down, have them spend 4 or 5 days here in South Florida in May. And then I have some guest artists join my faculty. So I was on the faculty at that time. I had a colleague, wonderful composer, John Christopher Nelson, who eventually went out to Texas at the University of North Texas. And what if I brought composers down and made them part of this faculty, and we gave master classes to young composers that we would select from students who would apply from around the country? And then the New World Symphony would play the music of the master artists, and I would put together a chamber group, a small chamber group that would present the music of these students. And so we did that for 3 or 4 years. It was extremely successful, you know, extremely successful. And I had some fantastic composers here. I mean, I had everybody from Earl Brown, Morton Sabotnik, George Crumb was here. I mean, you know, Lucas Foss, all these composers that, you know, you wouldn't have expected, but they came because, first of all, I had some contact with them. My colleagues had some contact with them. A year or two after this thing started, Fred Kaufman joined the faculty at FIU. You know, he came from up north. He had been up in Philadelphia, at a major conservatory in Philadelphia. So he had his contacts, and that festival was extremely, extremely important. And then eventually the symphony couldn't give us that time. I mean, they were basically donating the orchestra, which was incredible. You know, they were just donating the orchestra. And so after 4 or 5 years, they weren't able to do it anymore. So what I did is I took the festival and I converted it into New Music Miami. And at that point, what I did was it wasn't any longer for students, although we could do student pieces. But what we would do is we would do a big call for scores, and then we would also bring a couple of guest composers to be with us and to participate, a smaller reduced number because we didn't have the orchestra. And that's how that festival began, and how Nodus eventually began, the Nodus Ensemble. So the festival at first was New Music Miami, was this festival to a week-long festival or so to showcase new music from around the world. And most of it was chamber music, although solo works, electronics were also obviously incorporated. And we did that, I believe it started in 97, I think is when it started, 97 or 98. And so then we just started that for the next 3-4 years. And at one point it became the ISCM Festival. And at one point the chamber group that I had for the festival became Notice. Just at some point we had just, you know, instead of saying it, this is the festival chamber group, you know, New Music Miami Chamber Ensemble. No, we changed the name to Notice because there was a work by Fred Kaufman that we did for clarinet and piano that was called Notice, mm-hmm. N-O-D-U-S, which means knots. And so I thought, okay, we do this piece. That's the signature piece. Let's call the ensemble Notice. So we coined that, and that's how the name Notice started. And then what happened was that around that same time, I was very fortunate. I was getting performances at the World Music Days, which is a major festival, international festival, run by the International Society for Contemporary Music, ISCM. And at one of the festivals, the organizers, the General Assembly organizers, came to me and said, why don't you start a chapter of the ISCM in Miami? And I said, well, the U.S. already has a chapter, because typically each country has one chapter. So I said, they already have a chapter. It's in New York. And they said, yeah, that's fine, but you have a big country. You should do, and you have your festival, and you have lots of activities in Miami. So I won't get into all the nitty-gritty, all the details, but eventually I was able to get a chapter at FIU. So we're the Miami chapter of the International Society for Contemporary Music at FIU. And as a result, we added ISCM to the name of the festival, of the Music Miami Festival, because it gives more visibility to the festival. You know, it's on their webpage, on the ISCM webpage.
Supported by the university infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's really supported by the university. So that's another evolution of the festival. And basically what happened was, as we got more funding, a better budget and whatever, we were able to do more. We would bring more guests. And at some point about, I want to say 8, 9, 10 years ago, we stopped doing it all in 1 week. Mm-hmm. It used to be 1 week, and it was just way too much craziness to try to do this in 1 week, as you can imagine. So what we did is we said, okay, let's make the festival over a 3 or 4 month period of time. We have, right now we have 9 concerts in the festival, and we start in like mid-January and in mid-April. So it's typically 2 to 3 concerts a month, mm-hmm. which gives us a little breathing room. The Notice Ensemble is featured, but also is the Amarnay String Quartet, which are in residence at FIU. And they're very generous with their times, and they usually play the first and last concert. And then we bring, you know, guests. We bring guest performers and guest composers mm-hmm. to interact with our students, and as importantly, with our audience, our general audience. The concerts are all free, open to the public. They always have been. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we have support from the City of Miami Beach. We have support from the Dade County Council of the Arts and Sciences. We have support from the university, from the Latin American Caribbean Center, because we do a concert of music from Latin America, and we incorporate Latin American music into our festival, given where we are here in South Florida.
Before we move on to your music, it's a wonderful discussion. I really enjoy talking with you. And let me ask you about the aesthetic approach and compositional style that you have in your music. Like, as someone who studied with different composers and musicians like Dennis Kim, that you already mentioned, he's a Chinese-American composer. And the second one is famous composer Morton Feldman. I would love to hear about how you developed your compositional style while studying at University of Miami and attending the in-residence program with Morton Feldman. It is Atlantic Center for the Arts that is still active. I just Googled and I found they do, like, over the decades, they still have their resident composers that give the lectures. And not only composers in music, but also visual arts, painting, a lot of different arts are involved there.
Well, okay, so I was interested in studying with Dennis because he was interested in, as shown by his music and what he was teaching, mm-hmm. The composers from the New York School, Cage, the minimalist composers, which in many schools were not really being considered for what, you know, for a variety of reasons, which I won't get into necessarily at the moment. But to me, that music was very interesting because it was very different. And the experience of listening to that music was a very different experience than listening to a music that was more directional, right? That doesn't mean that music that's directional is not good music. It's just that I was interested, to me, I was very enamored with trying to develop a work, my own work, mm-hmm. that somehow referenced that world, right? And as I got working more and more with Dennis, I came to realize that what was really important for me is the idea that art, whether it's music or visual art or whatever, narrative art, should somehow change the way you perceive the world. Whether it's how you perceive sound or how you perceive image or how you perceive narrative or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And for me, the music coming out of that world and the music that I wanted to write did that. It changes how you listen to sound, what sound is, and it also changes your perception of time.
That's a big topic, and I want now to touch upon the concept of time in your philosophy and your aesthetic. Before that, just let me ask you, when you speak about the liberation of sound, that is the some concept of your, let's say, statement, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the liberation of sound is actually a phrase that Feldman used to say. So I remember when I worked with him. So my relationship with Feldman was I went up to the Atlantic Center for the Arts to work with him because I was obviously very enamored of what he was doing. And I had just finished my doctorate with Dennis Kamm. And I went up there to, luckily I was accepted. And it was a very, very unique situation. First of all, it was in February of 1985. And so it was kind of like universities were obviously in session. I had just finished my doctorate, so I didn't have to worry about that. I was out of school at the moment. I wasn't teaching anywhere. I took the spring semester off. And so when I went there, it was only me and his graduate assistant, who he later married, Barbara Monk. It was really the two of us. There was a third gentleman there who was on a sabbatical, and he was... We were, you know, she was in her whatever, maybe late 20s. I was just turning 30. And there was this gentleman who was another composer, was there, David Maves, really fantastic guy. But he was hardly ever there because he was on a sabbatical. And, you know, and he was a composer that Feldman had met somewhere else. They were friends. But his music was very, very different than anything else from us, from our music. Our music was very, you know, experimental. Mine was kind of minimalist in some ways. His music was kind of almost neoclassical, but he was hardly ever there. So what would happen every day is, starting at around 10 in the morning, I would show up, and Barbara was there because she was staying with Feldman, and we would spend the day with Feldman from 10 in the morning, sometimes till 10 at night, just depended upon when, you know, we wanted to adjourn. And Feldman would just, you know, I mean, his music was very long, so he, you know, he would talk and talk, and he would, you know, and ask us, and then he would put some music on. So if he just played two or three of his pieces that during the day, that's, you know, that's whatever, that's 5-6 hours,
right?
You know, because his piece, that when I was working with him, he was writing these really, really super long, yeah, pieces, right? And so it was really extremely fascinating, and I would ask him a million questions. Mm-hmm. And so and he, you know, Feldman was an extremely intelligent man. He was very opinionated, extremely opinionated, but extremely intelligent and just fascinating. And so when I would talk to him about time and music and stasis and what have you, he would always say, it's not about that. It's about liberating sound. If you liberate sound, it takes care of itself. And so, and I think what he's talking about is what he's talking about, because he was from, you know, he's from the group with Cage and the New York School, where at least Cage and Feldman both were very cryptic when they would talk. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. They would only just give you a little bit of information and you'd have to keep coming back. And so eventually we did wind up talking a little bit more about stasis and, you know, and the evolution of time. But for him, it was like focus on sound. Mm-hmm. Just focus on sound. Because that was one of the big critiques he had of my work. He said, you know, you're too conceptual. He said, you're thinking too much. He said, you need to focus more on the sound world. Think about the sound and what you're doing with it, right? And so, and that was kind of important, because going into my 3 weeks with him, my work, a lot of it was very much involved with conceptuality. Mm-hmm. The titles of the works, you know, what they were referencing, even though they were somewhat slowly unfolding, what have you, there wasn't as much emphasis on the importance of timbre and the sound world that I found with him. So when you hear one of my works, it could be 2 minutes long or 2 hours long. I always tell people that, you know, then. And then someone always says, oh, how long is this piece? And I said, don't worry, it's not 2 hours long. So it's okay. What I've come across over the last, I don't know, kind of thinking about this and getting into it, the whole idea of biocentrism kind of implies that all realities around us are constructs, right? They're constructs. That if you don't have a human, they don't exist. That doesn't mean there isn't something out there. Right. There's something out there. But the interaction with humans is what organizes it. It's kind of a quantum fog that's out there, right? There's a quantum fog. And then once you come into contact with, a human comes into contact with it, it takes some sort of shape. Mm-hmm. The trickier thing is that we all have to agree what that shape is, which we all think we do, but maybe we don't. Maybe we're all seeing different things. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing with time. Time is a construct. I mean, that's not, there's no, you know, even when we say objective time, what we're really talking about when we talk about objective time is a clock time that we've created, right? So we have a clock, a mechanism that measures time. So we call that objective time, mm-hmm. versus subjective time, which is kind of like the time that we create and that we feel. And so I try to adjust your clock. So you're not really attached to the objective clock as much.
Right.
It's a much more subjective clock. And the one statement that you made, which I have been quoted for, and it's a statement I made to the press, and when was it, back in the 90s somewhere, and when I was in Spain and I was interviewed, and I said, I don't mind that people think my work is strange. Mm-hmm. I don't mind that they think it's strange. But I want them to also think that it's very beautiful. Strange but beautiful. Beautiful but strange. I'm very happy. I'm fine with that.
Right.
I'm very fine with that. So. I mean, what's happened is, I've been doing this a long time. So what happened is, as I mean, I was mentioning the mid-80s, right, for my doctorate. Uh-huh. That's almost 40 years ago when I got my doctorate. So in 40 years, it's interesting to see how things have evolved. Not only just my music, because, you know, but just even how music is accepted, how music has changed. Like when I was doing this stuff in the 80s, forget it, you know. I mean, Feldman, one day before he passed away, he said to me one day, because, you know, I was already writing this music. It was really very close to his world. And he said, just be sure to duck, because they're going to throw stuff at you when you present this music, right? It was like, it was just not, you know how Feldman has become such a huge figure. When he was alive, he was not.
Right.
He was relatively well accepted in Europe, depending on the country. Mm. But in the States, no. I remember having a friend saying, you know, maybe you don't want Feldman to write a recommendation for you. He's very controversial.
Yeah, there is fun fact. I remember when we hanged out, you spoke about that recommendation that he wrote.
Yeah, that's, you know, like I said, with him, he was so cryptic. I never really thought, could never really tell what he thought, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I asked him for a recommendation once for this foundation, and he wrote the recommendation, you know, and I wasn't supposed to see it because I checked off. No, I waived my right to see this recommendation. And somehow one of the administrative staff or something made a mistake, and they sent me the package with the application and his recommendation. And the recommendation was so glowing. He was so, I mean, I could walk on water according to this guy, to this gentleman. So that was really amazing. And I have it up here on the wall.
Right? Yeah.
So when I don't, if I'm ever feeling a little down, I just go over and read it. So, okay. Morty thought it was pretty right. good. So, okay, I got it. So
to cheer you up.
But, yeah. And then I found out after he passed away years later that he spoke very highly of me and whatever. So, you know, I was very, very appreciative of that. And so, especially someone that was, I was very opinionated. I mean, he didn't like anything. he was very opinionated. Thank you.
Do you think he wasn't popular so much in the United States because of like people didn't understand the music, or there was some other things?
No, I think that's part of it. I think they didn't understand the music. I think that's part of it for sure. I mean, you know, 2-4 hour long pieces, right, and 3 hour long pieces and all that. You know, I mean, that's, you know, I get that. I understand why he wouldn't be. Plus, you know, he was very associated with the minimalist. Mm-hmm. There's a big article that John Rockwell wrote in the New York Times saying the biggest minimalist of them all, Morton Feldman, mm-hmm, which he didn't want to be associated with the minimalists. They were the minimalists. And he didn't want to have his music considered minimalist because even though it unfolded slowly and what have you and was restricted in material, it was not a pulse music. You know, at that time, the minimalists were pulse composers. Reich, Glass, Riley, all those composers, early John Adams, all those people, they were pulse. There was a real pulse. And his music is multiple pulses and floats along in time. So,
yeah, it's interesting that one of our books from the time when I studied musicology, actually, that is the book published by one of my professors from Serbia, Maria Masnikosa, and she's very recognized, one of the recognized scholars within minimalistic community, like what is the Society of Minimalism, I think that's the name of the society. And she divided minimalism like back then in 70s, 80s, or 60s into two groups. And the first one was like Reich and Glass that have the repetition. But the other group is based on minimalistic composers based on reductionism of materials. And she placed John Cage, Feldman, Christian Wolff, and those composers in that group.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the composers you just mentioned, Cage and Feldman, Brown, Christian Wolff, also known as the New York School, for me, that's just part of a line of American experimentalism.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. That continues on, you know, and eventually winds up, you know, branching off into the minimalists, because if it wasn't for these folks, the minimalists would not have been able to do what they did. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and if you talk to them, I mean, every one of them that I've talked to speaks in glowing terms about Feldman. Mm-hmm. Especially about Feldman. I mean, they all talk about Cage as well, primarily, but they all talk about Feldman, about how important his work was to them and how it allowed them to do what they did. So I see how, you know, you could say there's a certain reduction, a certain restriction, whatever, that's possible, especially in Cage to some degree and Feldman. Brown, maybe, because Earl Brown, basically Earl Sting, who was a great friend, Earl Sting was basically, because he was a jazz musician, you know, he was a trumpet player. And so his idea was to try to come up with a notation and a methodology that would allow performers to improvise like jazz improvisers do, but now in a style of expressionism, like a style of, like, you know, post-Webern, like a post-Webern atonal style. So if you listen to his music, even though it's somewhat more focused, perhaps, than some of the post-Webern composers, it has less material, obviously. Still, basically, it's very, you know, it's an atonal, very dissonant kind of pointillistic music.
Right.
It's somewhat reduced. But if you look at the notation is somewhat indeterminate, because the idea was, okay, I'm going to select the pitches, you select the rhythms. But you have to select them based on how close these notes are together on the page. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this system of music is only 10 seconds long.
Okay, so that's like a limited improvisation, some part of
improvisation. Exactly.
It's something similar to Klavierstück by Stockhausen.
Yes.
That he gave also the freedom, some part of the freedom to the performers.
Exactly. So the freedom there was more of a structural one. So the gestures are very, very determined. So determined. In the case of Boulez, I don't think he ever did that. I think Boulez had everything determined, super determined, notated and super determined.
Right, but he wrote that a very important article, Dice, right?
Well, that's because what happened is somehow he became somewhat enthralled with Cage and Cage's whole approach, and up to a point. And then at some point, that ended. And my own theory is, and I don't, you know, have anything necessarily directly to back this up, but my theory is that what happened with Boulez and with Cage is that Cage could create work that was extremely pointillistic and complex, rhythmically and harmonically, throwing dice, using random generators or whatever. And it was a music that their pianist, David Tudor, who was an incredible pianist as part of that group of composers, right? David Tudor was...
Yeah, cool.
Mm-hmm. Was an incredible pianist. And my feeling is that, you know, he played these pieces that were very complex, written by Cage, and he even created some improvisations that were extremely complex. David Tudor himself, because he was a composer as well, wasn't as well known as a composer, but was a composer, could create these very complex improvisations that sounded like Boulez.
Right.
And Boulez was calculating all this stuff out, right? Using total serialization, etc. And here's David Tudor kind of quasi-improvising, or here's Cage throwing dice, and he's creating a music that's somewhat similar. So I think at some point Boulez probably said, you know, I want to distance myself from that a little bit, right? Because if you can create something that comes similar to my world, and you're just throwing dice or you're improvising, obviously, I mean, I think he would disagree with that assessment. But I think that if you at least listen to those pieces on the surface and you compare them, there's a certain similarity. So that, I have a feeling, you know, again, I know that he and Feldman had a big falling out, so to speak, but that's because Morty was very opinionated and so was Boulez. So I'm sure they got into it personality wise.
Yeah.
So, but I know that, that he, before he distanced from Cage, he distanced from Feldman much earlier.
Boulez?
Yeah.
He distanced from Cage and Feldman.
He distanced from Feldman.
Yeah, there is the interview on YouTube. I watched it a long time ago when he said something like that, that he doesn't appreciate the music like from here, from the United States. Something like that. I forgot exactly, right. But yeah. Right. You spoke about the time as a big concept, a significant place in your art. And there is a experimental video opera that I just want to start the discussion about your music called Transcending Times. And that's the opera that was premiered, interestingly, in Zagreb, Croatia, in 2009 for soprano, chamber ensemble, narrator, voices, electronics, video. The video was done by Jacek Kolasinski and John Stewart, and text by Campbell McGrath. And just to let our listeners know, I already played some parts from that opera during this show.
That's a work that I had been thinking about for a while. And what I wanted to do was create a work that was interplanary, that was non-narrative. I didn't want to use a story. Because for me, the operas that are more interesting are the ones where if there is a narrative, it's kind of abstract. Mm-hmm. So for example, I think Einstein on the Beach, and I think a lot of Glass's operas are very interesting just because of the fact that they're somewhat abstract. You know, you can argue about the music if you want, which I'm not interested in doing, but for me, the way those operas unfold and conceptually how they're put together, to me, is pretty interesting. So not that I wanted to necessarily do that, but I wanted to come up with something that was non-narrative. So what happened is I was working on this for a while and coming up with different ideas. And I started collaborating with Jacek and with John on other projects that were not quite as big as this, right? They were smaller projects. There was a piece for this ensemble in Mexico City called Secuenza Sur. Mm-hmm. Secuenza Sur. And it was like a septet, if I recall. And they were playing at the Cervantino Festival, and they commissioned this piece from me that I wound up doing in the studios in Morelia, the CENMAS, mm-hmm. the Centro Nacional de para Música de las Artes Sonoras, run by Rodrigo Sigal. So I had an opportunity to do that there. And what I did was I talked to Jacek and John and about the concept for this piece, and they each came up with video. So there's video that begins the piece, in the first part of the piece, with electronics, mm-hmm. and there's video at the end. And what I did is I gave them electronics and just a very general idea of what was going on in the piece. And they came up with these images themselves, mm-hmm. right? So they came up with what they were gonna do. And I premiered the work at the Cervantino. It went over really well. The ensemble played it two or three times. An ensemble at DePaul University has done it since that time. Who else? Two or three people have done it, even though it's an older piece, but two or three people have done it. So I knew I could work with them. So I thought, you know what? I'm thinking of this opera, quote unquote opera, non-narrative opera. And I think what I'm gonna do is try to do something with them. So I mentioned it to Berislav Šipuš, who runs the Biennale, yeah. who was running the Biennale. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he's still running, but he was running the Biennale, the Zagreb Biennale. And he said, oh my God, that sounds fantastic. We should, you know, let's do it. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. So, So they produced the opera. They produced this opera, and I told them, this is what I'm thinking: five singers, like a main singer on stage behind the orchestra, and the orchestra is a chamber orchestra. It doesn't have to be huge. I think there was like 25, 30 players, something like that. Four singers surrounding the audience, and then a big screen with the video. Mm-hmm. And the singers surrounding the audience would have something that I probably way overuse because I love the sound: wine glasses and wind chimes. So they each had like a little station with wine glasses and wind chimes. And something that Jasa came up with, which was fantastic, was these little lights that you can clip, battery-powered lights that you can clip on your cuff of your shirt. And so because it was dark, when they had these lights. So wherever they put the lights, they moved them and they would go all over, light beams all over the place.
Performers,
and,
right?
Performers. Each of the singers had that on. Each of the singers. And so then when they would strike the wind chimes, the light would bounce off of the wind chimes.
Oh.
So cool. Visually it was very, very striking. So we we came up with these different types of effects. And to get back to the actual construction of the piece, what I basically did was following the procedure that I had for the piece in the Cervantino, is I said, okay, these folks work off of my electronics. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I created 10 tracks of electronics. I gave half of them to Jacek and half of them to John Stewart. Mm-hmm. And I staggered them. So track 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, whatever, one of them. I forget if that was John or Jacek. And then 2, 4, 6, 8 was the other one. So that there would be like this kind of rotating videos. And I did the same with Campbell McGrath. I said, here are 10 tracks of electronics. Come up with text, whatever you want. Here's the idea, transcending time. So at first I had this idea that was very narrative. And I'm not going to get into it because it was a story, mm-hmm. But eventually I refined it and distilled it down to, there's a first part of this work that refers to a state in the present. We're in a state in the present that needs to be changed. For whatever reason, it needs to be changed, right? When I started this, it was more specific, right? It was like, beings that needed to change and evolve because of blah, blah, blah. But I didn't. I said, we're in a state of the present that needs to change. Then in the middle of this work, we're going to go through an evolution. There's an evolution to something else. There's a transformation that's going on. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of this piece, we're in a new state. That's all I told them. I said, now you can interpret that however you want. So the first three or so tracks are the first part. The next three or four tracks are the next part. And the next three or four are the last part. And so they each went their own ways, and I had the electronics to work from. They eventually gave me the videos, and it was fascinating how somehow the videos kind of had a connectability. Because what did Jacek do? Jacek had images of his uncle in Poland that he dressed up in a biohazard suit, mm-hmm. that was painted with like little crosses and little ornaments, and so he had a hood and like sunglasses. He looked like something from another planet, right? And so he had images of his uncle walking on the countryside, walking by churches, walking in ruins. And what he did is he started with it in a very kind of, can I explain it, not very clear images, right? It was kind of fuzzy, kind of like what you would see like maybe on an old television with static, mm-hmm. right? And every track that followed after that, it got clearer and clearer and clearer until at the very end, the last track was crystal clear, super high definition. And his uncle was crossing a stream. On the other hand, John Stewart, which is what he typically does, is he puts a camera in front of something and lets it go, and lets it run for quite a while.
One sequence.
And then he comes back, and he puts... So the one thing he took quite a bit of were microwave antennas. Mm-hmm. And if you look at microwave antennas and you do that, you see that they move. You can't see them move, but if you record them like that, you're going to see that they move because they have to move in the wind or they fall. They break, but it's superimposed. So he starts to superimpose and he starts to compress the whole thing. So there's a bunch of times when you see microwave antennas and different images of microwave antennas in his stuff. You also see other verticalities. He has some like high grasses from the Everglades that he took images of that are moving. And it turns out that in some of the images that Jacek had of his uncle, mm-hmm. there were verticalities as well. So there was kind of like this relationship between the images.
Interesting.
That were there. And then the text was very interesting because McGrath's poetry is, you know, it's full of imagery and it's, you know, mm-hmm. I don't want to say it's traditional, but it's more like what you'd expect from poetry. Mm-hmm. But instead he did sound text. So he did all these words that sounded like the electronics, which was fascinating to me that he did that. But, you know, he listened to the electronics mm-hmm. very carefully and he came up with like these short poems, if you will, that the words were really what it was about, that the sound of the words was really not so much the meaning. Mm-hmm. So what I did is I had the singers reciting this text, whispering it, whatever. Most of the singing was vocalese. There was very little, you know, sung text. Mm-hmm. And the singers would move. They would move around the audience. Mm-hmm. They would move around the audience. So we had this performance and, you know, it went very well. You know, people seemed to really, really enjoy it. And we had lots of comments afterwards, right? And it was interesting to see how people interpret this. I mean, the idea was it was supposed to be somewhat abstract, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I wasn't telling them a story. You know, they could make up their own story based on what they were seeing. Right. And I remember like one person saying, oh, this was such a, you know, apocalyptic image, you know, it's, you know, the world's coming to an end. Mm-hmm. And that's what you were, you know, telling us about, you know, how terrible it is. And then there was another person that said, yeah, it kind of started kind of, you know, apocalyptic, but then it ended really positive. Like there's hope for the future because his uncle walked through this river and cleansed himself and he was in a very, you know, very sharp image and whatever. That was to some people that was very positive. And one other thing I'll mention, because there were lots of comments afterwards. One person said, that was really fantastic how the singers were whispering, mm-hmm. you know, and they were whispering. And they were whispering, and what they were doing was they were whispering the cell phone conversations that were going through the microwave antennas. Mm-hmm. So they had determined that the whispering and the talking quietly, you know, that happened in different places was a reference to the microwave antennas and the conversations that the microwave antennas project. Right. So that's what microwave antennas specifically do, is they're projecting all these conversations on cell phones. But that was the last thing we had in mind. We didn't, you know, there was no, when I had them whispering, it was for the timbral effect of the whispering. It wasn't necessarily to reference microwave antennas and conversations. But I just throw that in there so that you see the kind of stuff that it excites me, is to come up with something as relatively abstract and then have the audience tell you, you know, what they heard and what they saw.
Music of nothingness, flavors of darkness, flavors of darkness, music of nothingness.
We could say that your music or the way you approach aesthetics and composition techniques aligns with theories and that explore the concept of time from various perspectives. Let's have a chat about it. How do you perceive time in general and how does music contribute to shaping our standing of time? And lastly, how does your compositional technique expand the perception of time?
Okay, so I've been thinking about, you know, time and how time unfolds, and I've done some reading, a lot of reading. There's a really great book by Jonathan Kramer called The Time of Music, mm-hmm. which I recommend to everyone. I think he wrote it a long time ago. I mean, Jonathan passed away, geez, how long ago did he pass away? He was a professor at Columbia University, he was a composer, he was a good friend, and this book is a fascinating book because he tries to approach time, pacing, directionality, stasis, etc., analysis on all kinds of works. So Beethoven, Mozart, Debussy, everybody. And so it's like, how does time unfold in these works? Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of time unfolding has to do primarily with how materials unfold in a work. Like when is there repetition? When is there restriction of material? And like Feldman used to call it, when do you make a move? When you make a move is when you do something, right? That makes a certain moment of directionality that kind of, in many ways, negates your perception of the stasis that happened beforehand. And this is the example that I often give in his piano work, in Feldman's piano work, Triadic Memories. It's a very quiet, a slowly unfolding piece, very repetitive and quiet, and it's a long piece. And I forget exactly how long into it, but somewhere around 45, 50 minutes into the piece, there are these chords that come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And there are these repeated chords. And it kind of wakes everybody up because everybody's like, you know, sitting there listening to this kind of slowly unfolding piece. And they're like, you know, and these, you hear these chords and everybody jumps up and, wow, what is that? And then there's this chord. And the chords then stop and it goes back to what was going on before. Mm-hmm. And just that interruption, that move, as he probably would have called, or I'm sure he would have called it, that move changes your whole perception of what happened before. So the piece continues for another 10 or 15 minutes, whatever it is, and the piece ends. And when the piece is over, you don't know how long it was. If it had ended without those chords, you would have said, oh my God, this took all day. I was here for, you know, hours. But because of that interruption, your perception completely changes. So that's something I started exploring more and more over the last, whatever, couple of decades, I guess. So you'll hear in some of my pieces, not all of them, you'll hear that there are either shorter interruptions that change the pacing at the moment, or there are bigger ones that change the pacing at the moment. The moves, as Morty would have called it, mm-hmm. At his time. And that changes how you perceive what just happened beforehand. So I think that's a very valuable technique, if this is what you're trying to do, because then it really alters the perception of time. Now, the whole idea of time, like I said, I recommend the Kramer book. It's very, very, it's interesting, and there's lots of important information in there. What's happened to me is, like, over the last, I don't know how many years now, I've come across the whole idea of this biocentrism, which is kind of interesting to me. I mean, who knows if it's really true or not, but it's interesting to me because I'm a big believer in quantum physics, mm-hmm. and in the whole idea of, if you look at things at the smallest level possible of reality, they're really, really kind of irrational compared to what we think we experience around us. But a lot of those materials at that level, in some ways, can be mathematically deduced. And I'm a big fan of mathematics. So if they can be deduced mathematically, I think there's a good chance that they may be a possibility, right? And if that's the case, when you think about some of the concepts that we have at this level, at the smallest level, things change when they come into contact with humans. If you look at a subatomic particle, when you view that subatomic particle, as soon as you view it, it changes, just because you viewed it. So to me, that has a pretty big connection to this whole idea of biocentrism, where humans coming into contact with something, right, affect it, either make it real or they affect it. And so this summer I was at an artist residency on the island of Gotland, off the coast of Sweden, the south of Sweden, at the Visby International Center for Composers. And I was there for 3 weeks writing this piece for actually two works, but the main work I was writing there was for string quartet and mezzo-soprano that was just premiered back in January with the MRNA and this incredible mezzo-soprano, Rachel Calloway. And anyway, while I was there writing this piece, I came across this book called The Observer. And it's a fiction book, but it's written by one of the architects of this theory. And this theory has been around since, I think, 12, 14, something like that. It's been around for about 10 years. And it's created, I forget the gentleman's name, but he's basically a biologist.
Is it Robert Lanza?
Yeah, Robert Lanza. Mm-hmm. He's a biologist and a scientist. Mm-hmm.
There is a book, there is a Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Time, Space, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death.
Yes. And so the Observer is a book it's a novel, and it's about this woman who's a medical doctor, and you know, and she's summoned by an old friend who's doing research on the Cayman Islands in a little kind of lab that they have there, a medical facility. And the whole idea is to try to transcend the physicalness that we know. And really, there are themes about immortality and things like that. I don't want to give away the book because hopefully people will read it. I think it's a very interesting book. And so, like I say, what quantum physics, what happens to me that's kind of interesting is that the whole idea is that it's not like things that are out there aren't out there. It's just that we're defining what they are. In the way that Lanza describes it, it's a quantum fog. So things are like in a fog, in a foam, quantum foam or fog. And once we come into contact with them, they become whatever it is we're seeing.
Right.
And it's really interesting because I have a philosophy degree. One of my degrees is in philosophy. One of my undergrad degrees is in philosophy. And so for me, I was a big skeptic of just about everything, you know, because if you study philosophy, you have to doubt everything pretty much, right? Because it's not, you know, defined. It's more theory than anything else. It's not defined.
Right.
And so for me, you know, Descartes was like my starting point. I think, therefore I am. Everything else I don't trust, right? So to come into a kind of a biocentrism point of view where I'm like trusting this foam as becoming something that I'm touching out here is kind of a leap in some ways, but I find it kind of interesting. And so when it comes to time, time is a construct that we've made, mm-hmm. right? Again, that we've tried to perceive what that is in some ways. And we've come up with these devices like clocks and all that to try to mark it. But the fact of the matter is, if we weren't here, there wouldn't be any time. If human wasn't, you know, like the big thing is, if a tree falls in the forest, you know, and there's no one there, does it make any noise? Well, I mean, I would say that probably it makes sound waves. I don't know, you know, because it's when something falls, you know, hits and whatever, maybe it makes sound waves. But is there sound? Well, if there's no one there to perceive it, probably not. There's sound only, to me, happens when there's an interaction with a human. So are there sound waves there? I don't know, maybe, possibly, you know. But I think the same thing is true with time, because you're asking me about time. It's like, if it wasn't for us, there would be no time. There's no, not out there. It's not here or here or here or here. No, it's something we've constructed. And so then my game is to play with what we've constructed and trying to change how you perceive what we've constructed.
Yeah, I watched Lanza's lecture on YouTube he gave, I think, 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he started the lecture saying that finally, the biocentrism placed the biology over the other sciences like physics and mathematics. He's considering the time and the consciousness as the main fundamentals and fundamental factors in our perception. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I found a similarity. I found it inspiring and connecting with some other philosophical concepts from the past, like Heidegger's or Edmund Husserl, who discussed tones and music, pointing out retention and pretension, like some time that will happen in the future, but you have to notice and to have the experience to expect what is coming, like regarding the tones, and he considered tones as objects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's phenomenology. It's all about the essence. The essence of everything. What is the essence of it?
Yeah.
And in many ways, yeah, you know, with what Lanza's talking about, you know, it goes back to that. What is the essence? What is the essence of what we're seeing in front of me? You know, like, I have my computer in front of me. Is that really there? What is the essence of the computer? Is it what I'm seeing and interpreting, or is there something beyond that?
Right. Yeah, it depends. If there is a big brother, probably.
Well, that's a whole other possibility for sure.
Yeah. So. Let's now put all those theories and concepts together while discussing them in some of your works.
Sure.
We have chosen for today. The first one is una marea creciente, Spanish phrase, or translation is a rising tide, mm-hmm. right? And let me just, it's a non-narrative opera, something similar to transcending time. Mm-hmm. The same team of group of people worked on the piece, Jacek Kolaszynski, John Stewart, Campbell McGrath.
The only addition is that we have Augusto Soledad and his dance company. So they were dancers. So this was a huge, huge project that, because I had done the one in Zagreb, my colleagues, John and Jacek, and even Campbell to a lesser extent, because I don't see him as often, but you know, said, okay, what's the next thing? We did Transcending Time. What's going to be the next thing? What's the next thing? I said, I don't know. Let me think. Maybe, you know, let me think. So I went and met with Augusto, who I had written some music for his dance company. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know what? He said, let's do something really, really big. And he said, and let's go to the Knight Foundation and try to get funding. Because the Knight Foundation had a big grant, Arts Challenge Grant. This is back in 2015, I want to say, 2016, something like that. They had a big challenge grant. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, let me think about it. I'll go talk to John and Jacek and, you know, Campbell, and maybe all the five of us can get together. Let me see what. So in essence, what happened was I went back to them and I said, after conversations, we all kind of got to the point where we said, let's do something that deals with sea level rise, right? But not a narrative piece, something like, you know, closer to Transcending Time that we did in Zagreb. Mm-hmm. And let's make it site specific. And at that time, the Faena family was buying hotels and building them Fana is an Argentine builder, entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I think he's an architect actually by trade. And so what he did in Buenos Aires in Argentina was he put together a group of hotels, fixed them up, and had one space that was just for art, mm-hmm. for performances and for presentation of art. And that's what he started doing here in Miami Beach. So if you go to the Fana Hotel, you'll see there's the Fana Hotel, and the next to it are Fana Residences, condominiums. This is right on the water. It's gorgeous. And then if you go across the street, there's this big cylindrical building that's the Fana Forum. And that's where art is presented and events are presented and everything else. And so we started working on this piece, and it was an incredible group of people. They're all like really talented, you know. So, and we sat down and okay, and it was really tricky because the forum wasn't built. It was a structure in progress, right? So we would go there and, you know, and with hard hats on inside and, you know, look around and try to imagine what it was going to look like. And so what we wound up doing was creating work that was going to be site-specific, so there was going to be stations. After lots of conversation and lots of different ideas of, oh, we'll have the audience process and make a big, like, you know, parade. And right, we came up with all these ideas that we then scrapped. Mm-hmm. And finally, then we said, we're going to make stations. So we have the fountain. Downstairs is a fountain at the entryway mm-hmm. of this place. And like I said, it's a cylindrical building. And there's like a cutaway at the entrance, and there's a big fountain. So we're going to have some music, some sound and image going on there. And we'll have a dancer in there. And then the people walk up the stairs to the first floor. And the first floor has like a circular space with seating around this big circular kind of arena. And the walls are circular. So we'll project images on the walls. We have electronics everywhere, right? Electronics everywhere.
You mean electronics like speakers or what?
Speakers. They had sound systems there that they brought in, because the space doesn't have a lot of inherent stuff in it built in. So they brought a ton of sound for us, sound equipment. I mean, it was a big bill, but we had the funding, fortunately, to do it. But it was a big right. bill to bring projectors everywhere. Every place had a different thing. So the fountain downstairs had a projector that was projecting off of the wall behind the dancer. Images off of the wall behind the dancer. The first floor, when you go up the stairs, then you get into this building, it's a circular space. So there's a circular wall around you. So there's projections going on around you. And so then upstairs in the top room, it's a huge space. It has, one side has this big cupola, like a big, and then the other side is a big black box. Mm-hmm. And it's all connected, so it's huge. That's a huge, huge space. And we had projectors projecting down to the floor, because John had gotten a drone to take images of the bay, all the sea life in the bay, so you could see rays and fish and whatever there. And so he had those projected going down, and the dancers would move in and out of them, and so would the musicians. And then we had others that were projected on the wall, different parts of the wall. Jacek had a lot of images of water, different water, waterfalls, rain, all kinds of things that had to do with water. So the idea was to create a piece that suggested sea level rise, una marea creciente, a rising tide.
Right.
But was not a narrative, and it wasn't like, oh my God, we're all going to drown, or nothing like that. There was no message like that.
Right.
And it was relatively abstract, because then Campbell did his thing, because again, for each station, I made two or three pieces for each station. Yeah, I think it was two 15-minute pieces for each station. Mm-hmm. And each piece was repeated three times, because a 90-minute performance. Because the idea was you could come in and leave and go wherever. I mean, you didn't have to sit down, and it wasn't a concert.
Right.
And so downstairs was the dancer with electronics sound. I think that piece was like 12 minutes or something, and that was repeated a bunch of times because it's outside and people were walking in. Then the first floor had two singers, a contrabass player and a cellist, and they had chimes and some other percussion equipment, and again, electronics, sound, there was fixed media electronics. And then upstairs I had four singers and four instrumentalists, and they were stationed like in the middle of the hall. The hall is a big space, like they're in the middle hall. So I had the two instrumentalists in here and the two singers behind them. And the singers would move back and forth. And the instrumentalists would also move back and forth. So they had to move. So I had to design the music in such a way that they could still move and memorize the music, if you will. And then the dancers were moving throughout the whole space. It was choreographed. I think the first 30 minutes were choreographed. And then the next 60 minutes were all improvised.
Right.
And so, like I said, then there were like 500 people there.
A sea level rise is a common concern of all people who reside in the coastal areas of the United States. A few days ago, I just read the article that's a big threat on the both east and west coast.
Yes.
Especially in the coastal Florida area. So basically, the title came before you started working on the piece.
Yes, yes.
What made you find the text useful for the opera?
In this case, the text was a little bit more literal than it was in The Transcending Time. It still had a lot to do with the sound of the electronics, but in this case, there's like, I think, one section and for one of the stations where he's reciting names of sea gods, for example. So there's like a poetry regarding Neptune and, okay, you know, and all whatever, all the sea gods that, you know, that somehow, you know, but again, you know, if you hear that, it's like, okay, so what does that mean? Right. I mean, okay, I'm hearing, where are the sea gods? There's no sea gods, you know. So,
right.
But it was created the same way that we had did in Transcending Time.
Right, the same way. So let's hear the part of this non-narrative opera so our listeners can feel how the sound and the sonorities ascends and descends in register at different moments throughout the work, referring to sea waves, I suppose, right?
Yes.
There is the other instrumental piece with the same title, Una Marea Cresciante, that is Rising Tide. It's for solo violin and string orchestra, 14, 15 minutes long piece. There are a couple of other instruments like wind chimes and some glass that performers use. There is a score also available on your website. There is no virtuosity in traditional sense, but the control of sound is made with the prolonged and extended notes that matches your aesthetic that we talked about. The exploration of timbres possible on the instruments as impacted by extreme registers and particular bowings are also presented there. The combination of a string orchestra with the wind chimes and the sound of wine glasses creates a unique sonic blend of percussive sounds and high-pitched drone. What was the reason for selecting wind chimes and glasses to incorporate into the string orchestra?
Okay, so that goes back to an earlier piece. There's a piece of mine that's called The Distant Wind. Mm-hmm. And The Distant Wind is a piece that I wrote for this incredible Polish clarinetist, Wojciech Morozek, mm-hmm, who's an incredible clarinetist. And that piece is for a big orchestra and clarinet.
And that piece was performed in Serbia at the 25th International Review of Composers in Belgrade. That's interesting.
Right. But that's not the version. The version that was original was for a big orchestra.
Oh, okay.
So what happened is Wojciech said, listen, can you make a version for string orchestra, mm-hmm, and clarinet? If you make a version for string orchestra and clarinet, I think we can get more performances. And I said, okay, let me see what I can do. I said, I'll give it some thought. So I went and gave it some thought. And the fact that I have a big wind section, right, and percussion and piano and all this stuff with strings, obviously, a big string section. To try to make that into just strings was like, okay, that's not going to be very possible, right? So what I did was I said, okay, what can I do to enhance, to add to the string orchestra, right, when I'm making this version? So one of the things that came to mind was, okay, if I'd use wine glasses, right, I can take care of some of the pitches that perhaps, you know, I could had in the winds, right? And as far as the percussion goes, it's not around. So what if I add wind chimes, right, to add another timbral effect or layer? And as it turned out, as I started working on the piece, the only thing that remains the same is the clarinet part. Mm-hmm. Clarinet part is pretty much the same. The rest of the piece, I mean, there are still some, you know, sonorities and there's still some gestures that come from the big piece, but there's lots of things that aren't. So that's why that piece is called, that was done in Serbia, is called the Distant Wind 2.
I see, okay.
Distant Wind number 2. Mm-hmm. And that piece is recorded on an album that came out on Toccata Classics with some of my orchestral music. I think it's Orchestral Music Volume 2. Mm-hmm. And that same album has Una Maria Creciente.
I see.
So what happened then is this incredible violinist, Jennifer Choi, who wound up premiering and performing Una Maria Creciente, and I started discussing a piece and what could we do? And I thought of this piece of the string orchestra that I had just done with The Distant Wind and how successful that had been. And I thought, maybe I could do something similar using wind chimes and wine glasses like I did in that other piece. And so that's kind of like what happened. So as I was writing the piece, the title wasn't there. I started writing the piece. And the reason the title eventually came was because there are gestures that suggest rising tides. And since that's an important aspect of living in Miami Beach, I decided to title the piece Una Maria Creciente. And then everything that you just mentioned about control and all that is kind of what I'm involved with when it comes to works for soloist and ensemble.
Right.
Is it control of instruments, a control of the timbre, a control of the color, and it's very exposed. The music is extremely exposed. So you have to really, so if you're playing a really long note and it has to go from an ordinary sound to sul punticello to whatever, you have to have a lot of control to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So I have two pieces now that are called Una Maria Creciente. One is the violin and string orchestra, and the other one is the interdisciplinary piece. And it's interesting because when she played the piece, she said, there's almost no extended techniques. I thought you would fill this with extended techniques. And I said, no, it's about your sound. It's all about your sound. And so, and she's a wonderful player. She played it quite beautifully. And so
there are a lot of those meter changes throughout the score. Do the frequent meter changes or time signature in almost every measure affect our perception of time? I was thinking while I was listening to the piece, the listeners should feel it stretch or compress the time or both.
I'll tell you a story. When I came back from my 3 weeks with Feldman, right? Mm-hmm. I wrote this piece called The German Archer, mm-hmm. and dedicated it to him for two percussionists, clarinet and flute. Flute, clarinet, two percussion. And back then I was still playing clarinet, at least at a level well enough that I could play in public. And so I brought it back and I had a friend who's a conductor. Remember, I just got my doctorate. So I had a friend who was a conductor and a composer. And I said, listen, his name was Joe. I said, Joe, I need you to conduct this piece because we're going to do it at this concert in next month. And he says, okay, show it to us. So I gave it to him. He lived like close by in another apartment in the same complex. And mm-hmm. Calls me and he says, come on over here and I'll show you how to renotate this in 4/4. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, you don't get it. It's got to be like that, And he says, no one can play this like this. It's got to be 4/4. So I said, okay, this is what we're going to do. I'm going to renotate the first page in 4/4. And we're going to go to the rehearsal and we're going to play it the way it's written now, the way I've written it, and in 4/4. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see that it doesn't sound the same.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And sure enough, it didn't sound the same. So we kept it with all the changing meter.
Right.
So the changing meter has a very clear purpose, right? And it isn't just to compress time and all that, because that has more to do with the material and how it's done. It's on a bunch of different levels. One level is because I like the music. The music floats along. You can't tell that it's changing meter. Because when people think of changing meter, they think of changing pulse. Like the pulse is changing with the changing of the meter. Yeah, but that's not what's happening here. So the changing meters are mostly to delineate phrases and fragments, melodic fragments and melodic phrases, right? That's the basis for it is that. And on top of that, it keeps the players focused. they have to be on top of it, otherwise, you know.
My next question is related to silence in your music. So how do you approach silence in this piece particular and in general? Is it an important element that contributes to the dramatic effect of the work, or is it used to explore the potential of time further? And the last question is, what is the silent pedal that I found in some of your interviews?
Okay, so let's talk about that. So for me, there is no such thing as silence. So sound is always going, you know. And in my earlier music, there were a lot of silences. And but I became kind of disappointed with that because it depended so much on the room, the acoustics of the room, right? And the performers too. Mm-hmm. But it depended a lot on the room, it depended on the instruments themselves, and what have you. So I still use silences, but they're shorter than they used to be, and they're not quite as frequent, you know. But the whole idea is, again, that sound doesn't ever end. I mean, there's a theory that if we had the technology, we could hear Mozart talking. We could hear Jesus Christ talking, mm-hmm. because those vibrations are out in space somewhere. Mm-hmm. Those waves, they're dispersed, and yeah, we can't hear them, it's all gone, whatever. But if you had the technology to somehow find them and group them together, you could hear what's going on. So for me, it's like when a violin stops playing, the sound is still going. There's always a resonance. It's just that it's hard to hear. And so Feldman came up with this term, silent pedals. He said, yeah, there are silent pedals. Mm-hmm. And for him, what that means is obviously that the sound doesn't end. There's a pedal point that still sounds and it keeps going. And so for me, that's a big deal. Now, how do I decide how long the silences are and what have you? It depends on the sonority that's before it, right? That determines how long it should be. Where does it happen? It happens oftentimes depending upon the phrase. Mm-hmm. It sometimes depends on whether it's a very static part of a piece or whether we're going to a move, right? Sometimes you talked about a dramatic approach. Well, sometimes there's a little bit of a dramatic approach if it previews a move where we're going to get into something else, right? Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, that's really how the silences are really employed. Like I said, for a long time, a long time ago, the works that I wrote in the late 80s and in the 90s and whatever, there's some of them have lots of silences and, you know, and they're fine. I mean, those works. But for me, I became a little dissatisfied just because of that.
Right.
Sometimes it worked perfectly well. If they played the piece in a church, it was fantastic. If they played the piece in a dry hall, it was terrible.
I like your approach to the correlation between sound and silence and how they rely on each other, particularly considering a silence as the property that comes after some sound as an echo and that it's always hanging around us.
Exactly.
And the analogy with space acoustic also does make sense because placing a silence in the room with a great acoustics, like a church, a cathedral, where the sound will reverberate for a longer time, for a longer period, does make sense.
Exactly. That's the approach.
Just to remind our listeners, they are listening to episode number 11 on the Soundologia podcast and our dear guest, a composer and professor, Orlando Garcia. We are now opening the instrumental piece, Auschwitz Nunca Solvidaran. Mm-hmm. It's a title with program character, program music, because you have a lot of those titles that associate and refers to some external part or non-external music, let's say. It's interesting that Verk expresses your concerns for the actions that took place during the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. It's available on Toccata Classics. There are a lot of like very attractive clusters at the beginning, combinations of notes. And after that, I think we already mentioned that is the one of your approaches when you make those segments and the listeners can feel the change, the big change between in the formal aspects. How was the material presented here in terms of register, instrumentation, and pacing?
Well, for me, register, instrumentation, pacing, density, and the counterpoint between all those things mm-hmm. is what kind of guides me through a piece, right? I mean, it's a relatively intuitive process, but those are things that I'm very aware of. Like when is everybody playing? When is there a 2D? When is it a solo, right? When are you in the high register? When are you in the low register? When is it a mixed register? When is there a section of restricted kind of static material? When are things moving along? And so those things are a pretty big concern. This piece was written because the choir was going to Poland. Our choir back in the mid-90s was going to Poland. And they asked me for a work to take to Poland, and I had always wanted to write a piece that somehow made my sentiments regarding the Holocaust known. And they loved it. Yeah, let's do it, whatever. So, and they were going to join up with a small chamber orchestra, Poland, and do a small tour. So I wrote this piece, and the only text is Nunca se olvidarán, which is they'll never be forgotten. And that's not even, it's not sung, it's kind of whispered and murmured, and spoken very softly in a couple of spots and whatever. And the singing is all vocalese. So it turns out that the choir doesn't go to Poland. The trip gets canceled. They had some problems with funding. I forget exactly what the details are, but they weren't able to go. So I have this piece. And at that time, I still had that May in Miami festival mm-hmm. with the New World Symphony. So I proposed it to them and they said, sure, yeah, let's premiere it here. So they premiered it there with the same university choir, which at that time was a very good choir because there was actually funding to have a few professional singers in each voice part. So it was quite a pretty decent choir. And so we do the piece, it's over, it's here on the beach, Miami Beach, where the New World Symphony is. And there were people that came up to me and showed me their numbers. Mm-hmm. Because they had been at Auschwitz as children.
I see.
And they were crying. So I was like kind of shocked because when I wrote the piece, I wasn't thinking, about that. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, this is just my statement in memory of the people that perished at the Holocaust. There's no, I was not there. So I don't know. Because they said, oh, you captured the sounds. You captured all the sounds that I heard. you captured it all. And I was like, well, that's great. That's wonderful. I captured it, you know, and I'm glad it had such an impact. I said, but, you know, I wasn't there. So I'm like, so maybe it really puzzled me because as I just mentioned a few minutes ago, the way I work is I'm dealing with register and, you know, material and how that unfolds. And I'm not thinking. So I made an experiment. I took the piece and I took the score and I took the name off of it. And I played it for my graduate students. A couple of years later, I played the recording. I said, I have this piece and it's called, I forget what I called it, X equals Y squared, which is a formula I use to get the pitches or whatever. Oh, okay. So I played the piece for him. Piece is over. They said, oh, it's a beautiful piece, Dr. Garcia. It's really wonderful, the melodic material and the vocal parts and all that. But there was not a mention of Auschwitz,
right,
or of the sounds of Auschwitz or of any of that stuff. And this is going back to the, you know, whatever, mid to late 90s. It really hammered home to me how important context is.
Right, the program. But yeah, that's why I say program music in the title is very, very important. The context, of course.
It's all about the context. And it was interesting because if you look at the album, Carl Gann, who's a very important critic, composer, writer, you know.
Carl Gann, yeah,
good
I
friend,
know.
Mm-hmm. Carl Gann, he did the notes and he starts talking about the 12-tone row. He found that there's a 12-tone row. And yeah, there's a 12-tone row in the piece because, like Feldman, I can be a closet serialist sometimes. That's what he used to call himself, closet serial. So I can do that from time to time. And so, and even to the point where Kyle said, look, I followed your row and everything, but then you got off. Was that a mistake? I said, no, that wasn't a mistake. That's when you're a closet serialist, what you do. You use the row however you want. It's not, you know, I'm a closet serialist. I'm not trying to do this project for a class or something. I mean, I can change the row however I want and I can stop using it whenever I want, and which I do. I just used it. And then another person came up to me, another fantastic conductor, a good friend, came up to me and said, I saw that you have all this stuff that's kind of angular and kind of, you know, 12th tone. He said, was that an allusion to the Germans in your piece? And I said, no,
right.
It had nothing to do with the Germans.
That
has nothing to do with Germans. You know, he said, well, because it's Auschwitz. So I thought maybe that's how you were referencing the Germans. So that's, again, the stuff that I like very much. I find that really, you know, it's a little humorous, but I think it's really interesting that you put it out there. And if you make it abstract enough, but with some context.
This is the piece for the chorus and orchestra. And Nulka Selolvidaran is the phrase, and it says, like, they will never be forgotten.
That's right. That's
about
right.
The victims of Holocaust. They never actually say, the chorus never say that during the piece. They just mumble, whisper, right?
Yeah, they whispered, and it's just to create a texture.
They create a texture, like an effect, right?
Exactly. It was just really an effect.
But those clusters are really, really effective.
Well, again, that's the register thing we're talking about. So you have the contrabasses really, really low in the cluster, and then you have the violins up in harmonics that are really, really high in a
like
small.
Like flageolets.
Yeah. And so then the whole idea is that kind of counterpoint between that. And every time that's presented, it has a slight variation.
Because of the acoustic space?
The acoustic space. And then sometimes you'll see that gesture comes back, for example, without the violins, it's just the contrabasses.
And it's something similar in Trinity for the victims of Hiroshima.
To some extent, although, you know, he doesn't have the low cluster, he has the high cluster, and it's really, in his case, it's the highest note possible. In my case, they're defined pitches, even though they're hard to hear because they're so high up in the register, but they're very defined. In the Penderecki, he just says, play the highest note you can finger, whatever that is.
Thank you. those are big topics, Hiroshima, victims of Hiroshima and victims of Holocaust, that Penderecki and you paid tributes to through your music, because there are a lot of horrific events happening in the world. And right now we are surrounded with the horrific news that comes from the Middle East, from Gaza. Do you think that the music can change people's perception, and they can change anything in the world in terms of preventing some future events like those, the most horrific events?
I think it can probably shed light on them, you know, bring them into the attention. So I think that that can be an important thing. I mean, stopping it, no, probably not. But I mean, like right now, I have a number of pieces that deal with social justice issues. Again, although I present it in a kind of very abstract way, although the fact that I'm Cuban usually gives it some context. The piece I mentioned for string quartet and mezzo-soprano, and the piece is called Let Me Breathe. Mm-hmm. Déjame respirar, let me breathe. And so there's a lot of text in the piece. There are a lot of sounds, kind of white noise sounds that the string players have to do. They bow the sides of their instruments and whatever, and it creates kind of, and they bow different parts of their instrument, which creates kind of a sound. And the sopranos do breathing, mm-hmm. almost a meditative type of breathing. And like I said, when she does sing and sometimes speaks or whispers, there's a lot of things that deal with repression, text that, you know, such deals with repression and brutality. And the piece was done back in January, mm-hmm. here in Miami. And after the piece was over, this woman came up to me and said, I'm so proud to be Cuban, mm-hmm. which I thought was interesting. And I said, well, I'm proud to be Cuban too. Mm-hmm. But it never says anything about Cuba. It doesn't say anything about, it's very abstract. So it's, you know, so she figured I was talking about Cuba.
Right.
So, which I'm talking about everywhere, pretty much. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could be talking about George Floyd. I could be talking about, you know, so I'm very interested in doing that. I'm writing pieces that take that kind of abstract approach and somehow make a statement, and you can go from there. So
right. No, definitely arts and music can make people being better humans. Mm-hmm. That's definitely. And we are delighted to offer to our listeners a special giveaway today. Orlando Garcia has generously decided to give away 3 physical copies of his album. So if you're interested, please reach out to you, Professor, or us. What do you think is easier? You can leave your email that is available on FIU.
Of course, yeah. If you go to the School of Music at FIU, Florida International University, and you look directory and you look my name up, it's there. GarciaO@FIU.edu.
Amazing. So if you're interested, please reach out to Professor Garcia, the composer Orlando Garcia, to get one of those 3 copies. The similar thematic and the program music that you used in Auschwitz is also presented in your string quartet number 3, as you took the part of the poem I Never Saw Another Butterfly, that is the subtitle of 3rd quartet, and that's inspiration came from the poetry of children from Terezin.
Yep. Terezin, right. Yeah, that piece is, what happened with that is that the Amarnay one, you know, asked me for a string quartet, a new string quartet. And they said the only thing is that we somehow want it related to Holocaust theme, because they do concerts of music that's related to the Holocaust theme. And they also do music by Jewish composers that perished in the Holocaust, you know, and so they asked me for that. So what I decided to do was to contextualize the piece, I used the title of that book by the children from Terezin, I Never Saw Another Butterfly, which is a book that I have that I acquired at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. many years ago. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of puts it into context. But again, the music is you know, it's abstract music. So it's music that's, again, I'm based working on register, just like I did in Auschwitz. It's not, you know, I don't... But the title itself, and you know, and people can then they can then bring their own interpretation to what they're hearing.
There are a lot of dualities, like dichotomies between consonants and dissonance, sustained material versus melodic lines.
Right.
That is interesting that you mentioned in some of your interviews that you don't emphasize melodies, but here it's definitely some expressive melody.
Yeah, I don't feel like I emphasize them, but I do use them. They're included. So it's not like, you know, I mean, you're going back even to the Auschwitz piece, which is from 1994.
Right.
Yeah, I had a composer tell me when I was much younger, kind of a noted composer at the time, at a master class, he said, you know, you really write good melodies. You should write melodies. So I said, okay, I'll write melodies. So I'm still not sure what he meant by that, but
I think he meant to say that you was be more successful within commercial music, like writing for MTV superstars.
Probably. Although my melodies were very dissonant, so I don't know, okay. Why you thought that.
Yeah, that's some modern hip-hop R&B.
There you go.
Let's mention just a couple of your upcoming projects. There is a 17th Celebration retrospective concert taking place at the Wolfsonian in April. And there is something with the New World Symphony Orchestra. So please introduce to us.
Yeah, so on April 17, Wednesday, April 17 at 7:30 in the evening, for those of you that are in the South Florida area, at the Wolfsonian Museum, there's the Amornay String Quartet and an incredible pianist, Lindsay Gerritsen, are going to present several of my works, kind of just as a retrospective, because I just turned 70 back in February. So this is my 70th.
Congratulations,
anniversary. Professor. And so thank you. So they're going to do my second string quartet, Cuatro, which was written in 1990-something, 97, 98. So that's kind of the oldest piece. And then they're going to do a piece for a string quartet and a piano quintet, and a string trio and piano, a piano quartet. That's why we have Lindsay there, who's a wonderful pianist. Mm-hmm. So those pieces, probably one of the pieces that I did with Jacek Kolasinski for video and electronics will probably be also part of the show that evening. Mm-hmm. He's called The City Air Will Make You Free. And then possibly a duo with viola and cello that Jason Calloway and Michael Kloss, the incredible two of the performers in the Amornay, he's a riff for them. So it's a short little celebration. We'll talk a little bit about the works and how grateful I am to have them there as performers and how fortunate I've been over these 70 years to do what I do. And so that's that one. And then in January, there's a string orchestra piece that the New World Symphony will be premiering. I believe it's January 26th. I have to look it up. I think it's 2025. And that piece is a piece I'm writing this summer, and it's being published by C.F. Peters, which is part of an award I got from the American Academy of Arts and Letters about a year and a half ago or so. And so, which I'm very, you know, honored and pleased about. I mean, C.F. Peters is an incredible publisher, very selective, and this was a great award to get from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And so that's for premiere in January. And then in the middle of all that, I'll be working on a piece for the orchestra in Costa Rica based on some of the indigenous percussion instruments that you can find in Costa Rica, where I will be sampling those instruments and utilizing their frequency spectrums to create the sonorities in the piece. So the instruments will be in the piece, but the main focus of that is to try to utilize the kind of a spectral approach based on what those instruments, what the sound world is from those instruments. And that's for premiere, I think, in December. So I've got a few of these projects going.
Amazing. We have reached the end of today's show. Unfortunately, Professor, it was really a terrific conversation. And during this episode, I feel that not only me, but all my listeners had the opportunity to learn a lot, but also to be inspired by different topics we touched upon, particularly the concept of time, the meaning of silence, the some program music association with all horrific events that happened in the past during the Second World War, but also that are happening today that we should all be concerned about. Thank you, Professor, so much for allowing our platform to showcase your work. We wish you continued success in the future. Happy anniversary, 70th anniversary.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to be here. And I look forward to seeing you again in the not too distant future. And again, I appreciate you very much including me as part of this fantastic podcast series that you have. Congratulations.
If you would like more information about Orlando or the new Music Miami ISCM Festival, please check out the links in the description. To learn more about Soundologia, listen to our guests and previous shows, please visit us at soundologia.com. Also, remember to like our Facebook page and follow us on Instagram. Please consider writing a review on any platform where you listen to our content, as your feedback will help us grow. I'm your host, Peđa Kovačević, and if you have any comments or recommendations, please write to us. Let's catch up in just a few weeks. I'm bringing some terrific guests. Catalina von Wrangel, Rachel Weiss, Richard Verges from Noir Age Label. It's gonna be fun. Bye.